the American Tobacco Historic District in downtown Durham. This is Due South on WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. The First Amendment, widely considered to be the most important part of the U.S. Bill of Rights, it instills basic protections for American citizens and provides a backbone to our fragile democracy. The First Amendment is 232 years old and a mere 45 words long. Like most anything, it has limits, though there are some misconceptions. Recently, the First Amendment has returned to center stage as protesters have taken to college campuses from Providence, Rhode Island to Berkeley, California. Students exercising a First Amendment freedom to assemble when on public property have convened encampments. Some participants and gatherings have been deemed to have crossed a line. Well, what is the line? When does free speech transition to hate speech or something illegal? Has this line held, or has it changed over time, or with certain issues? Who gets to decide where the lines are? And what are the differences between a state or private university? We're exploring some of these questions, and I imagine plenty of others today on Due South, with a smart panel of voices who are set to offer their expertise and perspectives. Sarah Brown is news editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Ludington is on the line from nearby in Durham. She's clinical professor of law and director of the First Amendment Clinic at Duke Law School. Professor Ludington, thank you for being here.
Hi, it's a delight to be here.
Nick Perino is executive vice president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. FIRE is the acronym. Nico, glad to have you in the queue.
Glad to be here.
All right. Want to go next level with you real quick, Nico. Right off the top, your organization FIRE was founded 25 years ago as a nonpartisan, nonprofit group advocating for civil liberties on college campuses. FIRE has been described as something of a competitor or a little bit of a counterweight to the ACLU with some conservative and libertarian leanings. Is that fair? And is there anything else you would want to add just in brief off the top? We've obviously got a lot of time to chat.
Yeah, well, our principle is that if the speech at issue is protected by the First Amendment, we'll defend it. No apologies, no throat clearing. So to the extent people label that as a conservative enterprise, a liberal enterprise, or a libertarian enterprise, it doesn't really matter to me. We defend it if it is protected. And in 2022, we expanded our mission off college campuses. We used to be known as the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. We changed the in education part to and expression, and now we defend the free speech rights for all Americans.
And our final fourth panelist for this program is Irene Mulvey, president of the American Association of University Professors, AAUP for short, and on some subsequent references. She has a PhD in mathematics. Irene, we appreciate your time today.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
Same little exercise with you, please, as I imagine some of our listeners are going, AAUP, what now is that alphabet? What is that? AAUP founded more than a century ago with academic freedom as its guide star. Y'all are a pro-union organization. What else should our listeners know immediately?
Well, like you said, we were founded in 1915 and we have established the standards and policies that have made American higher education globally preeminent. We are the voice of higher education. We are the only organization protecting the profession as a whole, as opposed to disciplinary associations. We protect the profession as a whole, and our focus is shared governance, academic freedom for faculty, academic due process, and we are focused very strongly on organizing. We're chapter-based, so we have chapters. I'm president of the national AAUP, but we have chapters all over the country on campuses that uphold our principles.
I'm glad you're all here today, truly. This should be a very interesting conversation. Free speech, the rights, the lines, the misconceptions, the punishments, there's plenty to get to across the better part of the next hour. I want to start with something, I think, of a litmus test. The moment that we're in right now, I want us to think about it on a spectrum from unprecedented and a new chapter in the free speech annals of America to the latest chapter in college campus demonstrations. Where would you place the recent protests and why? Nico, why don't you go up first?
Well, America has a long history of unrest on college campuses dating back to the Vietnam era and even before, with building occupations, quad occupations, demands of administrations. Hamilton Hall, which was occupied by the Columbia University demonstrators before it was unoccupied, I guess, by the police, had been occupied, I believe, three times before. So this is not an unusual moment in American history. And frankly, when you have conversations about free speech, nothing is really ever new. A lot of the arguments for shutting down speech are the same as we've seen throughout history, and a lot of the arguments for shutting down student speech are the same we've seen throughout history.
Irene, the latest chapter, or is this more notable or going in a different direction?
Well, I'd agree with Nico. I mean, student activism has a long history, and from the perspective of the AAUP, we would argue that student activism is integral to learning on college campuses. And many of these institutions where they're cracking down on these protests actually use student activism as a marketing tool to their prospective students. You can go on their websites and see, here's an opportunity for activism at our school. And they, glamorize the protests of the 1960s as something, as, you know, like I said, as a marketing tool. But it's not unprecedented, the student activism, but this is a different issue, you know. So now we have a different issue. It's similar to the anti-apartheid protests, but I wouldn't say it's unprecedented, but it's extremely serious. It's what we're seeing here is an extreme, like, I don't know, I could go on and on, but the activism isn't unprecedented, but there are aspects of this situation which are unprecedented. For example, the violent crackdown so quickly on what were largely peaceful outdoor protests. I think that is new to this situation. But, you know, student activism has a long history, and I think it's, you know, supported by people in the United States.
Professor Ludington, what stands out to you, building on what Nico and Irene just talked about?
Yeah, what stands out for me in this circumstance is the involvement of very severe outside pressure. So Congress has taken, you know, has required at least four university presidents to appear before committees ostensibly to address concerns of anti-Semitism on campus. That just, you know, especially with two of them shortly thereafter having to step down from their position at Harvard and University of Pennsylvania, I think that exerted a lot of pressure on the university administrators to deal with students in taking that external pressure into account instead of just purely dealing with what was going on their campus. I also think in the backdrop and in the mind of every university administrator is a real concern about violence on campus. So in 2016 and 17, there were protests on campuses involving speaking events by some controversial conservative speakers that did, in a few cases, devolve into violence. And some people would say this is a pretextual concern of universities. On the other hand, I think any good university administrator is rightfully concerned about maintaining the safety of their campus.
And I would only note briefly that we have had some contained and isolated incidents of violence here in recent weeks, but there has not been widespread violence across the country as we think about this issue and a lot of demonstrations. We've got a couple more minutes here in this portion of our program before we're going to step aside briefly. I want to check in with Sarah Brown from the Chronicle of Higher Education. Your organization has been covering this and tracking this for weeks now. I want to go next level on some of the encampments. You've been tracking this, and I'm curious from your perspective as we think about roughly 100 of them, right, and hundreds of arrests, what stands out to you specific to the encampments and your role as a journalist tracking it?
Sure. So cumulatively, as you said, close to 100 colleges have seen encampments, sit-ins, or multi-day protests over the last 3 weeks or so. You know, most of those have been those encampments where students have set up tents on the quad or on a campus plaza and said, we will not leave until the university meets our demands. And for the most part, those demands do differ across campuses, but for the most part, protesters want their colleges to divest from Israel. And what that essentially means is they want their colleges to cut financial ties with companies that the activists say are helping to enable Israel's military to carry out strikes on Palestinians, on Gaza. And so, you know, I went to one of the encampments. I went to the encampment at Yale University, and it was a very peaceful space. It was a few tents were lined up around a campus plaza, and there were you know, threats potentially of disciplinary action, of possibility of, you know, police coming in and making arrests. So it was an interesting thing to see. At the time, it was very peaceful. Some protests have gotten more violent, but for the most part, colleges have said, you know, the reason that they are taking action against these encampments is because there's a campus safety issue. They say, you know, the tents are blocking throughways on campus, for example, or, you know, with students camping outside, there are a lot of potential for safety issues that we can't respond to as easily. And it requires staff resources to monitor these encampments. So a lot of colleges have really relied on those safety arguments to decide to shut down encampments. But that gets really tricky when you're talking about the First Amendment.
We're going to put a pin in that for a second. Sarah, I'll tee up for you that we're going to come back to that. And I want to hear a little bit more about what you make of those safety arguments, whether they hold water, and in what instances perhaps it's an argument where some have said, wait a second, this doesn't quite square up. We're just off and running, having a conversation today on Due South about the First Amendment, peaceful assembly, and when demonstrations turn to something else. We'll talk about some of the lines on the other side. Stay with us. This is Due South on WUNC. Here with us on Due South are Sarah Ludington, clinical professor of law and director of the First Amendment Clinic at Duke Law School, Nico Perino, executive vice president of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, Irene Mulvey, president of the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, and Sarah Brown. She's news editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. We're going to get to some of the bigger framework of the First Amendment in a moment, but I want to stick with the campus protests for another few questions or so. You talked about ceasefire. Well, I think you noted briefly, Sarah, a few moments ago. Ceasefire is one thing that some protesters have been calling for, but disinvestment is a major notable one. And if you would just briefly remind us, disinvestment isn't necessarily super quick. This is not like day trading stocks on your cell phone. This, if it were to happen, would take some time, correct?
Right. And college endowments are extremely complicated. And in fact, we actually don't know that much about a lot of college endowments and what exactly they're invested in. We know very little about public college endowments. We know almost nothing about private college endowments. And so part of the challenge here is that protesters are wanting their colleges to cut ties with companies that they say have ties to Israel. But most of these protesters don't actually know exactly what those ties are. So it's all a little bit abstract, and that makes this all really tricky. But, you know, colleges have said, you know, over the last few weeks, they have generally so far refused to commit to divestment. A handful of colleges have said, we will discuss the possibility of looking at our investments, but no one has said we are going to divest from Israel. No one has actually said that so far. And that's something that colleges have been pretty, you know, they have stuck to their points on that, and they have not been moved by the encampments.
Yeah, and there's actually another wrinkle here, which is that in the wake of October 7th, there's been this national conversation about whether colleges and universities should adopt principles of institutional neutrality on social and political issues. That is, they're not going to take positions on social and political issues. In the past, they've taken positions on everything from abortion to the war in Ukraine to the election of Donald Trump. And as we saw at Harvard, Claudine Gay wrote and then rewrote 7 different statements in the wake of October 7th because her various constituencies were upset with each iteration of it. And so there's this idea that colleges and universities should just get out of the social and political game, let their students and faculty be the critics. They're not going to be the critics. They're the host and sponsors of them. the University of North Carolina system actually adopted a resolution that said that they were going to be neutral on social and political issues. So this raises a question, right? When you talk about divestment, if you are going to invest or not invest in certain things for social or political reasons, does that violate the resolution that the state system adopted for the University of North Carolina? We at FIRE tend to believe that colleges and universities should adopt positions of institutional neutrality. It creates a chilling effect for students and faculty members when the colleges put their thumb on the scale or take a position on a certain issue. The dissenters might not feel as free to speak up or might feel that they will be punished if they do speak up. So this raises an interesting question. Is the investment or not investment taking a position on a social or political issue?
Nico, I want you to just maybe answer that question, because to my ear, that sounds a bit utopic. How can a $5 billion investment, a $5 billion endowment, which, for example, UNC Chapel Hill has, how can they not either passively or actively take certain political or social stances? You can't remove all of that from a $5 billion investment, can you?
Well, it depends what the purpose of your investment is. If it's to make money and ensure the financial stability of your institution, then your guiding light should be investing in things that will ensure the long-term financial stability of your institution. If it's something different, like supporting social causes or not supporting certain wars, then maybe that would guide your financial investments. The other question here is that, you know, some of these investments are in index funds like the S&P 500, which might include within them some companies that do business with Israel. And investing in index funds is one of the best ways to make money in the market. So would that require these colleges and universities, if they take the protesters' demands, to disinvest from the S&P 500? There's a lot of different wires and they're crossing, and it gets very confusing very quickly.
I would only say briefly, I think it might be the best way to invest money, but we'll leave that conversation
some would say, yes,
for another time. But I want to go a step further here, which is to say, what if a school with an endowment says we're going to put $250 million in renewable energy? And that becomes a flashpoint because, well, I mean, why are they doing this? Are they camping? They're taking a position because of climate change. A lot of different investment choices could inherently become political or welcome some kind of criticism.
Yeah, of course. And this is where these long line drawing issues with the Calvin Report, which came from the University of Chicago, which kind of put forward these positions of institutional neutrality. It's not quite clear, although it does seem from reading between the lines that if you adopt the Calvin Report position on these sorts of issues, that it would also address issues of financial investments.
Hundreds of arrests have taken place across the country. Remind us, please, Sarah, from y'all's reporting, what are the charges that we have seen, predominantly or in small part?
We're predominantly seeing students being charged with trespassing, which is a little bit, it may sound a little bit odd. They're being charged with trespassing on their own campuses. But essentially, in these cases, police have declared this encampment an encampment, an unlawful assembly, and given protesters a warning or several warnings to disperse. And if they don't, they will be arrested for trespassing. So that's most of what we've seen. We have seen a handful of other situations, you know, people being charged with assault on a police officer, which is a more serious crime. But for the most part, we've seen trespassing charges. One thing that remains to be seen is how many of these charges will actually be prosecuted. It's not 100% clear, like, are all of these local jurisdictions going to press forward with charges against now over 2,000 people who've been arrested in these campus protests?
Right, because that can gum up the judicial system. As Nico noted earlier, there are all kinds of lines, and district attorneys, elected district attorneys, often straddle these lines or camp out positions, no pun intended, on certain sides of the lines. Professor Ludington, to the best of your knowledge, has anybody been arrested for violating the First Amendment here in recent weeks?
Not to the best of my knowledge, but then again, it is difficult to parse from news reports sometimes what exactly is going on. It strikes me that a lot of universities have been very, very meticulous in the procedures they follow to make sure that they are using neutral laws and rules of decision. So they can't arrest people for speech. And I want to be clear that hate speech, even virulent anti-Semitic speech is protected speech under the First Amendment. So no, any public university cannot, because their public universities are an arm of the state. They're obligated to conform their activity to the Constitution. They cannot arrest students for their speech, but they can impose neutral, what we call neutral time, place, and manner restrictions. So if the university believes that a protest is interfering with legitimate functions of the university, for example, it's noisy and students can't take exams, or it's blocking an entrance into an academic building or the library so students can't access those buildings, then they can, you know, give the protesters warnings and say, you know, this is an unauthorized encampment. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. after a number of warnings, they can clear the encampment. But no, if it's a public university, it can't do so on the basis of speech.
Irene Mulvey, we heard from Sarah Brown earlier in the program about safety issues, perception or real. And I'm interested to hear from you. What do you make of the claims, the narrative that, you know, these tent encampments are just plainly a disruption to college life, and they're a nuisance, and they're a safety problem, and that's why they had to come down?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm happy to talk about the safety issues, but I think when we're talking about the safety issues and what they're being arrested for, and are these rules about time, place, and manner being applied consistently, or are they being, you know, applied in ways that they don't apply, that they're not applied to other groups? I think we're losing sight of something, which is the issues that the students. I mean, I'm not going to get into the specifics of the issues the students, but I think we need to understand that this is happening because the students feel very strongly about what's happening in the world. They're learning, and I come from the perspective of higher education. They're learning stuff. We're teaching them research skills. We're teaching them how to analyze an argument. We're teaching them that even the most deeply held belief has to be subject to scrutiny. And in the process of this education, they're very upset about something. They're upset to think that the tuition dollars they pay to these institutions are going into an endowment, and they want to know what that's funding. These are really, really important issues. And I think that's sort of getting lost I hate to see that getting lost in the discussion about were these arrests justified, or, you know, are the time, place, and manner restrictions being applied consistently? I think, you know, from my perspective, that what concerns me is how quickly the university administrations brought in militarized police in riot gear against students who have strong feelings about what they're seeing in the world, and they're doing what we want them to do in higher education is to think deeply about the world they live in and what kind of world they want to live in. So I think for us this militarized response to protests that began as largely peaceful and outdoors was completely disproportionate. And I think the way forward, and also it's a free speech argument, yes, but it's a free speech argument on college campuses. And so that makes it a little more narrow. We're not just talking about free speech in, you know, out in the public square. We're talking about free speech on a college campus. And our goal on a college campus is education. Education in service of understanding. So the way to move forward is to talk to the students, to understand what they're doing, and to sit at the table and negotiate with them, which is a remarkable educational opportunity for these students to be able to negotiate and understand that not all your demands are met in negotiations, but you have to make compromises and you have to work with the people on the other side. But I think for us, it's the right to free speech and peaceful protest is really important, especially on a college campus. And the militarized response we saw was disproportionate is an understatement. And to go a little further, it feels as if it's all happening as a result of a broader assault on higher education, a political assault on higher education, where, you know, higher education is a pillar of democracy. We need institutional autonomy and independence so that higher ed can be a check on corporate corruption, government corruption. I mean, higher education is supposed to serve the public good. And there's an assault on higher education these days, which is moving it towards serving private interests and corporate interests and political interests. And that is a very dangerous road to go down. And I feel like that's somehow the context in which all this is happening.
Irene Mulvey is president of the AAUP. Nico Perino, executive vice president of FIRE, please jump in here.
Yeah, I don't envy the jobs of college and university administrators at this moment. So what do you do with a situation like Columbia, where the protesters told reporters, we will not be moved unless by force? And this is after the university had moved to virtual classes and it's considering shutting down its commencement. Do you let them continue to do that? It's my position that force should be the last resort. But if the protesters are telling you that force is the only resort to get your campus back up and running, I don't envy the college and university administrators, and I don't want a Monday morning quarterback. But I should say that as just a basic principle, peaceful protests should be protected. The open areas of campus, to the extent that they exist, should be available for public protest. Neutral time, place, and manner restrictions can be put in place, and often they are put in place for the security reasons that we saw unfold at UCLA, where you had two clashing protesters and counter-protesters going at each other in the middle of the night, and I think the reporting suggested there were six police officers there. And college and university administrators are telling you it's because we can't have 24-hour police presence, particularly when you have hundreds, if not thousands, of people participating in the protests. So, you know, but then you also have situations like UT Austin, where the students are organizing a walkout for Palestine. It's very peaceful. They're told to bring blankets. There are no tents in sight. And they bring in armed police officers on horseback. That's going too far. That's going too far. But, you know, and again, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation college and university administrators are putting themselves in.
I would like
let's
to...
Let's turn to...
I would like to say real quick that... I do not feel a lot. I feel a little sympathy for college presidents, but these individuals get paid a lot of money to do this job. And right now, at this crucial time, the obligation of a college president is to stand up with a full-throated and robust defense of academic freedom. And you can do this with dealing with the protests. I think, you know, insisting that they stay peaceful or within, outdoor areas. I know some schools have accepted the fact that they're sort of breaking rules, but they're going to let them stay there. You can work. You can do this. And I feel like college presidents get paid a lot of money for this job. And now's the time to step up.
But the rules need to be enforced equally. So my colleague Keith Whittington over at Yale, he sits on FIRE's board, wrote in Sarah's paper there, the Chronicle of Higher Education, what happens when encampments are set up and the students are taking their marching orders from Steve Bannon instead of Susan Sarandon? Like, you need to be willing to accept that these principles that you establish need to be applied in viewpoint neutral ways.
Sarah Brown, you are going to jump in here.
I wanted to say that when we're talking about free speech, one of the things that's really strikes me about this current moment of student protest is that, you know, I've been as a journalist covering student activism for the better part of the last decade. And one thing that is distinct about this round of protests is that the pro-Palestinian student encampments believe that they are exercising their free speech rights. A subset of the campus community believes that many of the things that these protesters are saying are anti-Semitic, qualify as harassment. And that is something that is somewhat distinct about these protests, is that if you are a college or a university, you have to figure out not only how to protect the free speech rights of protesters, but to respond to people in your campus community who say the chants that those protesters are using, we consider those to be anti-Semitic. We feel unsafe on campus now. And you have to respond to both communities at the same moment. It's really difficult.
Briefly, Professor, you got about 30 seconds.
I was just going to say, I think another really important job of the campus administrator is to tend to its community. I mean, a university is a community of learners by design. It's an incredibly diverse group of people, and all viewpoints need to be honored and encouraged. And the students who feel threatened by pro-Palestinian messages, they deserve to be protected by the university, even as those students' rights to speak are being protected.
Sarah Ludington is clinical professor of law and director of the First Amendment Clinic at Duke Law School. She's part of our panel here on Due South talking about recent protests and First Amendment protections. Also here is Nico Perino, executive vice president of FIRE, Sarah Brown, news editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Irene Mulvey, president of the American Association of University Professors. Oh, by the way, there were a handful of campuses where there weren't any arrests, and the protesters dispersed peacefully after conversations and some sort of brokered compromise with campus administrators. We'll talk about what, if anything, was to be learned from those locations on the other side. This is Due South on WUNC. Welcome back. It's Due South on listener-supported WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. We're chatting about free speech, campus protests, and plenty of the offshoots this hour on the program. And we're speaking with Nico Perino, Executive Vice President of the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, Irene Mulvey, President of the American Association of University Professors, Sarah Brown, News Editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and Sarah Ludington, Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the First Amendment Clinic at Duke Law School. I want to spend a couple of moments here on the First Amendment. I hope it's not too duh for our listeners, but I think it is maybe worth a little bit of a reminder. First Amendment protects, of course, five areas: speech, religion, press, assembly, and the right to petition your government. We're focusing largely on assembly today. Professor Ludington, what are the largely agreed upon lines about when assembly is not protected?
Well, the largely agreed upon lines are the time, place, and manner restrictions that I referred to earlier. So if we're talking about the public square, the members of the public have a right from time immemorial to assemble on sidewalks and public parks and use those spaces for speech activities. But that is also limited in some ways by the rest of the public's need to walk down those sidewalks and also their right to also use the park. So time, place, and manner restrictions are things like restrictions on the time of use, restrictions on littering, and other behavior that diminishes the value of the space and the ability of other people to use it. So most public universities will have a permitting system in place that has to be neutral in terms of content, but most protests that take place on a public university have to be permitted by a central office at that university. And it'll have, you know, it'll be located in a particular place on a particular day for a certain duration. If it's near classes, there will be volume limits, etc. At a private university, you know, private universities don't have to conform to the First Amendment, I think, because of the principles of academic freedom. I believe they should, and I believe most universities, private universities, try to, and they will also have a similar permitting system in place.
Anything to add from any of our panelists? I thought that was pretty robust, but I don't want to cut others off if there's anything to add to it.
Yeah, well, one of the big flashpoints is what qualifies as discriminatory harassment. right? When the presidents of MIT, Penn, and Harvard testified in front of Congress, I believe it was on December 5th, but sometime in December, they were asked about calls for Jewish genocide and whether those calls are banned under the school's policies. These are private schools, so they can adopt whatever policies they want, although a lot of them voluntarily commit to free speech principles, I believe. Schools like Yale, for example, say that here you're free to think the unthinkable, mention the unmentionable, and challenge the unchangeable. Glowing language like that. And you have a conversation in Congress where they're talking about chants like Intifada and From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free. And then you get you get the follow-up with Elise Stefanik's question, yes or no, are calls for Jewish genocide prohibited under your student code of conduct, the implication being that those chants would be. And they said context matters. And they were right. Whenever you're talking about unprotected speech, you need to look at the facts. Context always matters. Now, if you're chasing a student, happens to be Jewish, wearing a Star of David on their necklace, and you're shouting Intifada, Intifada, Intifada at them, that might count as Davis peer-on-peer discriminatory harassment and could be punished, and the universities could lose their federal funds if they don't do what's necessary to create a safe environment for that student. But single chants, offensive though they may be, almost never count as discriminatory harassment. And there's a good reason we don't ban abstract calls for genocide. I mean, both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict right now are accusing the other side of genocide. You have people who right now say that bans on gender-affirming care is a genocide against the unborn. You have pro-lifers who say that pro-choicers it's a genocide against trans kids. And then you have pro-lifers who are saying that abortion is a genocide against the unborn. That's what happens when you have these vague speech codes that are untethered from the law. They are wielded by either side of a political conflict to go after their enemies. So I do worry about untethering our speech codes on these college campuses from the law and having them being used as political tools for ideological opponents.
Irene Mulvey, I'd love for you to respond to that. Do you share that concern?
Well, I wanted to add say something because Nick brought up those hearings. I think it's important to just make – I just wanted to make the point that how dangerous it is to those were, as Nick pointed out, presidents of private universities called up in front of a federal House committee. And I think everyone should be concerned about the fact that the federal government, we're going down the road of the federal government feeling they are entitled to dictate what happens on our campus, on private college campuses. I think that's extremely dangerous. And it's not the federal government. It's the elected people in power at that moment feeling that they are able to dictate what is happening in our classrooms and on our campuses. And I think that's really, really dangerous. I just wanted to make that point since sure. Nick brought up those hearings, which I say in air quotes because nobody was listening and they were really just performative political theater.
From Nico Perino to Irene Mulvey over to Professor Ludington.
Yeah, I wanted to circle back a little bit to Nico's point about the line between speech and harassment. And if the line between, that is a tricky line to draw. It is very context specific. But one thing that I think university administrators need to attend to is this idea that just because something can be said doesn't mean it should be said. And hate speech, while it may be legal, has very real, measurable, harmful effects on the targets of that speech. In a university community, hate speech might be lawful, but it has no place there. And education on civic discourse and how to express a point vehemently, passionately, but without threatening or putting other members of the community into fear or, to making them feel unwelcome. That is a skill, and it's an essential skill if we're going to survive in this incredibly heterogeneous community in the United States. We need to learn how to express ourselves and to receive differing viewpoints without resorting to violence or harassment.
Nico Perino, please step in.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Supreme Court has said that one man's vulgarity is another's lyric, right? And defining what hate speech is a challenge in any context, particularly on college campuses. We had a case at Emerson College a few years back where a conservative student group wanted to hand out stickers that said China kind of sus on it. Sus is, you know, young person slang for suspicious. This is in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The college president in that case sent a community-wide email accusing the student group of anti-Asian hate and bias. A large proportion of that student group was itself Asian, and the vice president of the student group was herself Asian. So, you know, hate speech is often in the eye of the beholder. In the 1970s, you had the National Union of Students in England pass a hate speech code. And they, in the process of doing so, solicited the main Zionist student organization in England to support their efforts. And they did. A few years later, that same union determined that Zionism was a form of racist hate speech and banned their speech on campus. So I agree in principle with Professor Ludington that, you know, can versus should is very important, but I haven't seen college and university administrators always draw the best lines there.
We're chatting here on Due South about the First Amendment, the right to peacefully assemble, and much of what has transpired across the nation in recent weeks. I want to get to some of the encampments that had a different ending in a moment. But before we do, Sarah Brown, you just wagged a finger at me, which is a friendly wagging of the finger, to be clear. What were you going to say?
I wanted to say that in these conversations about speech on campus, I think it's important to remember that, especially over the past decade or so, students have been calling for their colleges, especially students from marginalized communities, students of color, LGBTQ students, have been calling on their colleges to create more welcoming campuses. And a lot of the recent discussions about free speech have bumped up against calls from students to have safer campuses, have campuses that are more welcoming for students from a variety of backgrounds. And there has been a lot of discussion about whether free speech and inclusion are at odds. I don't really want to litigate that, but I think it is important to remember that a lot of the challenges with speech today on campuses stem from students who, an increasingly diverse population of students coming to campuses, and they have been raising concerns that they feel that, you know, the expression of certain viewpoints is making them feel unwelcome on their campus. And I think that that is an important piece of context to remember.
All right. Thank you for that. Meanwhile, there were a few campuses where encampments didn't result in arrests or law enforcement in riot gear, but rather protesters voluntarily dispersed. Sarah, the Chronicle of Higher Ed noted in one recent report that, quote, three encampments at Evergreen State College, Northwestern University, and Brown University secured promises from administrators in return for an effective end to their encampments. Two others at Michigan State University and the University of Pittsburgh ended without incident, close quote. I'd also add to the list Rutgers University in New Jersey, this after protesters and administrators reached a compromise late last week. And in California, it appears Berkeley is going to do what Berkeley has done for a long time, with one university official telling the Washington Post in recent days, quote, it's best to deal with these protests with negotiations rather than police force, as long as they are nonviolent, close quote. Berkeley has ostensibly said they expect the protest there to disperse come summer when most of the students go home. I'm interested to hear from each of you, probably, unfortunately, just because of time, briefly on this. What are your takeaways from the schools where things ended far more quietly in recent weeks? Irene, do you want to start?
I think what we saw on these campuses is exactly what we should see on college campuses, which is a willingness to engage with each other and learn and talk and communicate, free and open inquiry, and to move forward through education. And I think that's where we should be going. I mean, I feel like it's almost what's surprising to me is the crackdowns that happened so quickly, as opposed to trying to work with the students ahead of time. But I do, you know, I applaud those institutions
Northwestern, Evergreen State College, Rutgers, Brown, they took their students seriously. The students were treated seriously. Their demands were listened to, and agreement was reached. And I feel like this is how we move forward, through education.
Professor Ludington, what did you learn from these campuses that didn't have riot gear and arrests transpire?
I think it's a testament to the possibility of speech. You know, the remedy to speech is more speech. And, you know, the administrators who were willing to negotiate dialogue and, as Irene said, take seriously the concerns of students from, you know, all parts of the community are the ones who I think are best able to defuse a situation before it gets out of hand. I also tend to think that those universities probably have a really good campus culture of civic discourse, civic and civil discourse.
Nico?
Yeah, I don't have much to say on this other than one way to approach it, right? And that's one way to, you know, help the encampments end and for everyone to move on to finals and commencement season.
Sarah, anything to add? I've got one more if we've got time for it. But Sarah, go ahead.
So with these agreements, it's been a way for student protesters to, you know, they've promoted these agreements as a key first step on their broader demands. And administrators have been able to hail them as a way to de-escalate tensions and ensure the safety of all students. So one thing that's important to keep in mind now is what happens next. So we have seen other student protest movements that have resulted in agreements with administrators to take certain steps. And what remains to be seen is, will administrators take those steps? There is a history of, frankly, administrators waiting out the clock on students. Students are only around campus for a few years. It is easy to just kind of wait it out and move on. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens this summer, when students are mostly off campus. What happens this fall with the presidential election? How will colleges weigh these agreements to discuss divestment when that's something that they've generally been unwilling to do? I think, you know, having covered student activism for some years, it's been a mixed bag in terms of colleges' willingness to follow through on these agreements that they've reached with students. In many cases, they have created task forces, for example, to increase the diversity of their campuses, increase the diversity of their faculty, if that was an agreement that was reached. And it hasn't always resulted in an outcome that the student protesters were looking for. So that really remains to be seen going forward.
Sarah Brown is news editor for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Also here with us on Due South this hour have been Nico Perino, Executive Vice President of FIRE, Irene Mulvey, President of AAUP, and Sarah Ludington, Clinical Professor of Law and Director of the First Amendment Clinic at Duke Law School. I want to say thank you to all of you and also just kind of extend an open invite as things play out this week, perhaps most notably at the University of Chicago. I think this story is far from over and would love to reconvene you all again at some point if you're up for it. So thank you, and hopefully we'll chat again soon.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
And thank you for being with us on this hour. Remember that you can find other episodes of Due South at our website, duesouthradio.org. Due South is a production of WUNC and a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Our producers are Stacia Brown, Cole Del Charco, and Rachel McCarthy. Sean Rue in as technical director this week. Aaron Kiever is our executive producer, and Quilla produced our theme music. For Leonita Inge, my name is Jeff Tiberi. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.